Arshil here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, happy Friday. Welcome back to the show. Two quick notes before we get started. Number one, because it's Friday, there is a Substack that's coming out today. So if you have not signed up for our Substack, you can find a link at the top of the show notes where you can get expanded coverage, get input on the show, all those good things. Secondly, we're coming to you with a live episode on Friday. That's because we've expanded the show ever since we launched our Supercast subscription. We're not paywalling these. We want to make sure that everyone can get access to them. So if you could afford to support our work, if you believe in the mission of The Realignment, we'd love for you to go to realignment.supercast.com, subscribe, $5, $50 a year, $500 for a lifetime membership. It's really important. Helps us keep the show going with our expanded coverage. Now, today's episode. This is a great show. This is with an author named Christopher Blattman. He is a professor at the University of Chicago, and he's written a new book. It's called Why We Fight, The Roots of War and the Paths to Peace. This book actually came as a recommendation from a listener because we spent a lot of time focusing on the war in Ukraine and all those different topics of probable or possible war with China over Taiwan. So this whole debate of like how does actually war come about and how, why, and shouldn't stop being just treated as the norm is just incredibly important. So a lot of really great stuff here. Of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. Hope you enjoy this episode. And we've got another discussion episode between me and Sarah coming on Tuesday. So definitely send in any notes for what we should talk about. Chris Blattman, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
It's really good to have you too. Let me just start with the most direct question that I'm sure is on every audience member's mind right now. How afraid are you of World War III breaking out? We're recording this on May 9th. This is a particularly auspicious day because this is the day that Russia is undergoing their annual, I mean, I'm not sure if this is even happening because of the time difference, but on the 9th, it's the day that Russia celebrates their victory over Nazi Germany in 1945. There was fear that this could signify an escalation of the war, the use of a nuclear weapon, some game changer there. So on this day then, how do you just think about a fear of escalation?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tiny, but I remember something. I saw some famous economists standing up almost 20 years ago, and they were asked, what's the risk of the United States having an Argentina-style financial meltdown? And they said, it's vanishingly small, but for the first time in our lives, it feels like the answer is not zero, and that's terrifying. And so that's a little bit how I feel. There's a little bit of risk. It went up a little bit, and that should be terrifying. But you know what it comes down to, and this is the big theme of the book, is just war is just so unimaginably costly, especially nuclear war. Everyone's going to strive to avoid it, and so I draw comfort from that.
You say everyone is striving to avoid it, and we'll get into the World War II plane bomber metaphor because it's really useful. But that is going to sound the way you just phrased that everyone is trying to avoid it. That feels very counterintuitive because these big stories we have, Hitler pushes and pushes and pushes until a war happens. Yeah. You know, you have all of the European powers at the start of World War I who are just primed to go to war. They wouldn't have predicted it would have started in Sarajevo, but they were just primed to actually go to war. So explain what you mean by that statement.
Well, I mean, World War I's a great example where there were, you know, there were 20 Sarajevos in the preceding 20 years, if not more, these sort of diplomatic flashpoints where the leaders really walked back from war because it was so going to be so unimaginably costly. These stories that you hear of, oh, it'll be a merry little war that will be home by Christmas, was not the majority view. It's sort of a cherry-picked quote. And, you know, even look at what's happening now. When everyone thinks, well, Putin, obviously he was going to invade Ukraine. Well, I mean, for 20 years, he's tried every other underhanded means possible to co-opt Ukraine. Dark money, propaganda, assassinations, support for separatists. It was a last resort. So he strove to use every other means possible. Obviously, ultimately, he used it, and sometimes they do. But there's a tendency to overlook that, which I think makes us then misdiagnose war and also how to treat it.
I think the quote I pulled from the book on this was, and you put it this way, for every one war that happened, there are 1,000 that didn't happen. And the way you basically explain this is, just explain what you're really getting at there. Because once again, unless you're really looking at all of those 1,000 instances, which by definition, we're not going to talk about, who remembers 1911, let's say, that's one of those Sarajevos. Yeah. There's a conflict between the Germans and the English over Morocco and the French. No one, you don't think of that normally.
Yeah. Who remembers March 9th, 2022, 2 weeks into the invasion, when India accidentally launched a cruise missile at Pakistan and calm ensued? That we don't pay attention. If that had led to a giant war, we'd all be talking about how it was inevitable. But in fact, they've maintained this tense peace. You know, it's hard to call this a peace, but this tense sort of situation over Kashmir for a very long time. And so that happens again and again. You know, sometimes we have data on that. So political scientists have actually gone and they've looked at every ethnic group that could engage in violence with the neighboring ethnic group in Africa or Eastern Europe over years and decades. And they do find that maybe 1 in 1,000 does so in a given year, which means 999 didn't. And it's the same with ethnic and religious riots in cities in India. We think of a lot of these places as perpetually riotous. It's the exception. If you do the same exercise with nations, you come to the same conclusion. Even just look at Russia. So not only did Putin try every other means possible to subjugate its neighbors, Ukraine, but it has tried every other means possible to subjugate its other neighbors and its own people, Belarus, Kazakhstan, you know, the whole list goes on, and it's mostly done so without invasion. So it wasn't just, it wasn't kind, it was like cold-hearted, cruel, calculating, self-interested on the part of Putin and or Russia, but it didn't amount to warfare. And so the starting point is just to sort of say, let's look at war through that lens, sort of like, you know, and not be the doctor who thinks that everybody's critically ill, but at least recognizes that the normal state of human health is, the normal state of humanity is health. And then we'll do a better job. Pay attention to the critically ill, of course, right? But then we'll do a better job, just like doctors who are at least aware of human health are going to, you know, provide better treatment.
When political scientists and you are a political scientist and folks like yourself think of this idea of war is ruinous. Mm-hmm. Is there a possibility that this is just a cultural assumption? So for example, the ancient Spartans, obviously they had a different conception. Now there's a conversation about leadership structure and nature of society, but obviously ancient Sparta would have a different cultural assumption about war than basically any society on earth. Let's insert Imperial Japan, the Bushido code. Like there were cultural assumptions that would not see war as ruinous. How would we think about that part?
I mean, you're thinking of martial cultures in history. I mean, it's worth noting that even the Spartans did everything they could to avoid war most of the time. They armed. They were martial societies in order to be so strong that their enemies would bow before them, as most did. That's how they conquered the Peloponnese. And then it's interesting, when the ancient Greeks did go to war, for example, it used to be very short. It was one battle, right? And then it kind of got decided and everyone was like, enough of that. Now, that is not what happened in the Peloponnesian War. And I write about that in the book, but that was exceptional, right? That long war was hugely unusual. Most wars up to that point were very, very short. And that's true. So most of the time we don't fight because it's so ruinous. And then when we do fight, most of those wars are short. And we just have a tendency to pay attention, like we have to. We have to pay attention to the critically ill patients. But we don't want to forget that most people get better quickly.
What you just said brings to mind a question, because I was listening to a podcast you did to prep for this show, and you all were talking about I think this is with Tyler Cowen, but just the cost, let's say, of like military expenditures that don't end up getting used. Like right now, we have a $1 trillion F-35 program that, knock on wood, most likely will not result in a single shot being fired in anger. Right. We have 13 aircraft carriers, on and on and on and on. One could argue that that's a massive waste of money. But the counter to that argument is, well, that those things function to serve as deterrents. To the Spartan example you could give, Sparta did not have to fight wars because it was strong. From a game theory perspective, how should we think of deterrence, spending, those different bits?
Yeah. I mean, we arm, and because we arm and because fighting would be costly, we have this powerful incentive to avoid fighting. And usually we do. The problem, and so we avoid that inefficient thing. That's the way the game theorists would think about fighting. But what the arming is super inefficient as well, right? Like, we'd be all much better off if all of our, if, you know, if two rivals didn't have to spend 20% of their GDP, their national income on arming, we could spend that on lots of other great things. Instead, we just park things in silos and fly planes around and maybe occasionally blow things up, which is a terrible use of resources. So it would be nice if we could all agree and make a commitment to all disarm. And sometimes we do, right? We do that. We've done that in the Americas. We're not armed against Canada. We found ways to solve that problem. But when we haven't, you know, that's a actually more difficult problem. The problem of arming is harder to solve than the problem of war. And so we just have this huge diversion of resources into planes and spears and whatever, and it's hard to avoid.
When you talk about that example of we're not armed against Canada, well, you know, as, and I'm sure you know of his history, is we're a little past this now, but like a little over 100 years ago, like, we had plans to invade Canada in case a Caribbean colonial Monroe Doctrine conflict happened with the United Kingdom. Yet that's just solved. If you think of Western Europe, you know, we think of Germany and France as very chill. And in the case of Germany, almost a quasi-pacifistic power. But just, you know, 60, 80 years ago, Alsace-Lorraine, all these things don't seem to mean that much, resulted in millions and millions of people dying. How do you think of these conflicts as just remaining and then just basically ending? How do you just think about that idea?
Yeah, you can see this pattern throughout the Americas. Like, Latin America spent most of the 19th century at war with one another, and now it's almost unthinkable. There's a few reasons for that. I mean, the starting point is war is so ruinous, our societies are constantly looking for ways to get around it. You know, the first half of Why We Fight talks about why we fight, but the second half talks about how we get to peace. And there's all these things you can do to sort of make it even more costly to go to war. And I think these big alliances that we see in the world, like this alliance that we see in the Americas, or the Americas and NATO, but also China's sphere of influence, Russia's sphere of influence, what they do, one is they sort of build lots of connective tissue. You know, they integrate economies so that actually going to war against one another is even more peaceful, is more problematic than before. All of these alliances are what political scientists would call hegemonic alliances, meaning you have one big power, China, Russia, the United States, that basically acts as like the peacekeeper in that region. That's going to, if two nations were going to go to war, you know, they're going to impose some, there'll be sanctions, they'll coordinate action, right? And so you have these almost, it's not a state for this period, but it's a little bit like a state-like entity. So there's, I talk in the book about how all of the things we do sort of roll back the reasons for conflict and force people to focus on the costs or make it more costly. And I think that's what we've managed to do, but obviously not completely, because there's still this competition between these great power, like hegemonic alliances that still exist in the world.
You know, I'm glad you brought up that example, because I think it brings to mind an idea which is difficult for people to really sort through, because there's two sides to it, which is, on the one side, let's say you're talking to the left-leaning part of this audience, you would say, hegemony, stability, what are you talking about? You know, hegemony means insert wars in the Middle East, insert interventions in Latin America in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, insert basically forever in that context, right? So yeah, we even go to the 18th century there too. So basically, how do we basically reconcile the idea that hegemonic power stabilizes, but is destabilizing?
Yeah, there's nothing to say. So when I say peace, I mean the absence of prolonged, intense fighting between rivals. And there's nothing that has to be just about that, right? So if an imperial power marches into a weaker nation and says, we want tribute, and also we want you to stop fighting with your neighbors, and just focus more energy on producing stuff and giving us tribute, right? Which is a pattern throughout history, right? And that happens peacefully, in the sense that there isn't a rebellion and a revolution, but it is repressive, right? That's peace without justice, right? So that's repressive, and I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm just saying that happens because of this basic thing, War is ruinous. Rebellion is ruinous. Revolution is ruinous. And so most of the time it doesn't happen. And so it's one reason why we can have really persistent injustices and inequalities over centuries, and why most human societies, imperial societies, domestic societies, whatever, have been basically a small group, a small elite group exploiting the rest without revolt, because revolting was just too costly.
How do you then think of the claim that, especially in this conflict, the fact that we're going into a more multipolar world where big powers, whether they're Russia, China, the United States, can't exercise hegemonic control? Do you think that is going to be a stabilizing or destabilizing fact?
I mean, that's a great question. I mean, this basic incentive that war is ruinous and so we should be striving to avoid it. Now, of course, I didn't write a book called Why We Don't Fight. I wrote a book called Why We Fight Because We Do. Every answer to why we fight is a reason that a society or its leaders ignored the costs. And it's so, and there's lots of, in some sense, you've left us already to like the 201 level or something, but in the sense that it's actually harder to, in some ways, it's in that multipolar world when you have many actors, it can actually be more difficult for all these adversaries to find that peaceful equilibrium. And so multipolarity just complicates it in a way that, like, two people bargaining saying, listen, we could split this pie. We can both agree we don't want to destroy a share of it and then argue over the shattered remains. Let's just split it before we shatter it. Well, that just gets a little bit more complicated. And there's more ways for that to break down when there's several people fighting over that pie.
So yeah, let's take it back to 101 level then. Explain the bargaining idea. This is the problem when you read the book. You kind of I skipped over things. Apologies to the audience there. Let's get to bargaining. And then what do you mean by bargaining as a metaphor for, let's say, what conflict resolution, I think, is a good way to put it.
Yeah. I mean, what I'm trying to do in the book is to say, let's bring together these folks over here who are thinking strategically, meaning they use game theory. All right. And they're trying to think about why cold, calculating, rational actors would still go to war. Let's bring them together with the psychologists who have come up with lots of reasons why we're not rational, or why we value all sorts of things that don't seem rational and why we go to war. And then let's bring in some of the other, you know, political science and economics, and let's try to integrate it. Okay. And one of the basic starting points is to say that it goes back, Mao said, politics is war without bloodshed. And von Clausewitz, the famous Russian general or German general, said, war is politics by other means. And what they were all pointing out is that rivals are struggling over how to divide an issue, who's going to control a territory, whatever it is that you're competing over. And you can solve that through politics or through war. And they're both means of bargaining, right? And war is just bargaining through bloodshed. And the thing they didn't mention, but many others have mentioned, is, well, one of those bargaining strategies is really, really horrendous and destroys something that you're fighting over first. So we'd rather use politics than bloodshed. And so the book is to say that all of these reasons, and there's a reason for every war and a war for every reason, is basically, you know, the answer to why we fight is always because we ignored the costs, and we did it for one of these more strategic game theoretic reasons, or we did it for one of these more psychological reasons, or we did it because of the way political power is organized. And so I kind of say, well, it all comes down into, you can sort those basically into five kinds of explanations that these different disciplines have given us. So I use this sort of bargaining framework, which is basically arithmetic, but basically comes from game theory, to organize all of the non-strategic explanations as well.
And we'll get into the different reasons for war, but I'm curious, and this is, once again, we're using a metaphor, this is describing different ideas, so there are limits to it, but how often are there wars where there just is nothing up for bargain? So, for example, let's say Eastern Europe during World War II. Let's put aside Jews for a second in Eastern Europe, because obviously that's a campaign of extermination. But even, you know, to the Russian or Ukrainian or Belarusian Slav, like the entire Lebensraum plan was that they would eventually just be would die out and Germany would get everything. There's no bargain there. So that's a situation where you could argue it was a huge mistake. And the ironic thing is that at first, funnily enough, like, you know, the Nazis were actually kind of not greeted quite as liberators, but it wasn't as if Ukrainians or Belarusians were huge fans of Stalin. So initially there probably was some bargaining spaces and maybe a Ukrainian nationalist would be down for a Ukrainian puppet state against the Soviet Union. That's the bargaining part. But once you accede to a Lebensraum replacement plan, there's no negotiating or bargaining to be had. So how often do you think that type of situation is happening? Because you set this up by saying, look, wars only happen 1 out of every 1,000. Then of that one, those situations where it really is literal life or death would seem to be 0.001 of one.
So, yeah, although I would say, let's look at China, for example. China has a huge number of languages and ethnicities within its border and it's been engaged in a decades-long effort to homogenize that population as much as possible in terms of language and norms. And it does that through education campaigns. It does that through encouraging Han migration. It does that through repression. It does that through with carrots as well as sticks. So it's not a survival. They haven't decided to exterminate every person of non-Han ethnicity. They've decided to try to gradually integrate them into like a larger whole. And that's kind of, and there are lots of successful, you know, your listeners who are here can't see me using air quotes, examples of this is what France did, right? Most people in the territory we now think of as France didn't speak French, and they didn't believe in they weren't necessarily followers of Catholicism, even if they were Christians and so on, right? And so France and many of the most quote unquote successful nations we see today are successful examples of this internal colonization. And so I think all of these projects, what Russia's trying to do in Ukraine and what maybe Hitler was trying to do in Eastern Europe are merely to sort of continue that historical tradition and we remember them as failed efforts, right? And they were all cruel and self-interested and ideological, but they're a regular appearance in history. And to submit to that, which peoples have, lots of people revolt against that, right? And as they should, I'll cheer them on. But to submit to that has also been a very common, maybe a more common pattern in history. And that's another example of peace being unjust.
And it's interesting because I want to, and we really get the reasons, but I'm just interested in a couple of things you said.
Sure.
You talk about wars being ruinous.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think something that's difficult is we could probably think of examples where war isn't ruinous. And maybe, and you get into this a bit with interest and who controls power and those different bits.
Yep.
But at a core level though, think of World War II for the United States.
Right.
Hundreds of thousands of Americans die.
Yeah.
Interpersonally ruinous. But a baby boom happens, so the society, this sounds so callous, I'm just trying to be frank here. The society replenishes itself. The whole rest of the world is flattened, so the economy is the greatest it probably ever will be. On and on and on and on, those different bits. So how should we think of it? It just seems like, and this is why it's difficult with the like 1 for 1,000 example, we just are always going to see these examples of countries calculating that actually war isn't ruinous. It seems like that's probably those examples probably serve as a bad model for other situations.
So we have to separate out, there was a period of time when America was simply selling stuff to Europe to wage war that was helping the American economy boom, and they were paying no cost whatsoever, right? So that was an example we'll talk about in a minute, that's kind of an unchecked interest in the sense that they had it's sort of like a weapon. Of course, you're like, well, weapons manufacturers do well in war, so of course they like war. And I'm like, yeah, exactly. So America was basically a big weapons manufacturer for a period of time. So if we take that away, and then we just look at the point when America's actually fighting and waging the war, It's not to say that there were never any upsides from the baby, but it's hard to imagine that they I just think they would have been much better off if that America would have been inordinately better off if everything had resolved itself the day before they were going to declare war, you know, before Pearl Harbor, probably. And then to the extent they did do better, it was only because all of the other powers in the world beat themselves to a pulp and then they could be the hegemon. So it was this sort of accidental byproduct of other people fighting. So that's maybe these rare exceptions.
And I'm realizing at a core level, like you said, let's put aside the pre-war example here. The US is obviously on the defensive in World War II in the sense that the Pearl Harbor happens, Hitler declares war on the United States. Is there a offensive, is there a reality that war is more ruinous for an offensive, for someone who's trying to push war than someone who's defending against war?
So, I mean, there's one story that I try to deflate towards the end of the book, and it comes from very famous scholars like Charles Tilly, who have said that, well, war in the short run is destructive, but actually most of we only have powerful states and systems of taxation and public goods and all the things that give us stability and prosperity and all our technology today because war was fought. And so it's like this accidental byproduct. Ian Morris is another historian who's made this point. And the argument I make is maybe it's an accidental byproduct. It still wasn't the optimal thing for them to choose to do in the short run. But actually, I think they're all selecting the positive cases. They're saying, well, I can find an instance, which is, you know, Europe for 300 years, where this proved to be a good thing. But actually, if you look at all the cases, that's not usually what happens. War just pounds people back into the Stone Age, and it's unimaginably destructive. And by the way, all the supposed benefits you could get from war in terms of technology, better states, taxation, you didn't actually need to fight. You just needed the tense competition, right? And historians have another term for that. They call it defensive modernization. It's the idea that we sort of rise to the occasion because of the threat of fighting. And so in some sense, I think that the real answer is the motor of history is the competition and the threat of violence. And we've moved furthest ahead when we don't actually do this terrible thing, which is fight.
Two things. One, Ian Morris is coming on the show next month. So
Him if he agrees. You can ask
him. Yeah, no, shout out to him. We did a great episode on Ukraine a few months ago. But I was wondering how I was going to bring back in the World War II bomber metaphor because I didn't follow up on it. But you just set me up perfectly. So thank you. Because what comes to mind when you point out that you could cherry pick these examples of war being positive, what about the other 99 countries, nations, ethnicities, cultures that were abolished by war, right? So was war good for the Byzantine Empire? Yeah. No, clearly not. It wasn't good for it. Yeah. Yes, the Ottomans, it's good for them for a bit, for the next 500 years. But so basically, what I'm getting at basically is this idea of the bomber metaphor only focusing on the survivors.
Yeah.
Explain what we're talking about there.
Right. So in the book, I talk about the sort of now famous example where these planes would come back from sorties over Europe in World War II, and the wings and the body of the plane were covered in bullet holes. And so the army instructed the engineers to armor those parts of the plane. And there was sort of a military think tank run by a now very famous statistician named Abraham Wald, who said, actually, no, armor the other parts of the plane, armor the cockpit, armor the engines, because you don't see any bullets there because those bullets are on the missing planes. Because when they got hit in the cockpits, they went down, which kind of makes sense, right? And this is one of those things that makes sense in retrospect, but was really easy for a whole war machine to get wrong. And it's a classic example of survivor bias. You're only paying attention to one part of the sample. And we actually do the opposite thing. When we look at war, we kind of are only looking at the bullet riddled carcasses of these planes in the ocean. And we see they're just tip to tail covered in bullet holes. And we don't really know which ones were the crews. We don't actually know it was the cockpit hits that brought them down. We just see all these other things. And so we get distracted by all these causes for war. And so the book is sort of saying, listen, so the whole point of starting off by saying, well, often we don't fight is because it helps us figure out why we do fight.
And once again, set up well. Let's get into five of those reasons, which sure. you outline. And you make this clear that the claim isn't that these don't interact within one another, right? Because this is a complicated ecosystem. But let's just start with the first one that is probably coming to mind for most listeners anyways, just unchecked interests.
Right. So this is just the idea that a leader is unaccountable. And when leaders are unaccountable, then they're going to ignore a lot of the costs. So take Putin as an example, because as a personalized autocratic dictator, it's sort of the extremity of the case, which is to say that obviously war is costly and risky to him, but a lot of the death, a lot of the destruction, he can safely ignore because he can't really be held accountable for that. And even the death, mostly the death and destruction to his own people. And what's more, it also frees him to pursue private interests, things that preserve his power, but are against the broader interests of the book. And war can sometimes do that. And so that's in some sense like the first starting point. And it doesn't actually come to us either really from game theory or from, I mean, not the game theory of war or the psychology of war. It just comes from people who think about basic problems of politics and how it's hard to hold our leaders accountable, and bad things happen when our leaders aren't held accountable.
And unchecked interests also brings to mind specific interest groups within a society. You referenced this earlier, but you know, it's been a longstanding issue. And I actually have I actually really hate this theory of why war happens. So feel free to disagree or correct me. But you know, this idea that, like, for example, World War One, weapons interests, this is the Smedley Butler, interest drove us into war. This is the, you know, you see this a bit in World War Two. You saw this a lot from folks in the period before the war in Ukraine actually started. This is why we were talking about it. There were people saying, well, the war on terror gravy train has happened, so Raytheon is going hard to cause the next war. Right. I think this is just actually, in all the historical examples, what frustrates me, let me just rant for a quick second. What frustrates me about this example is that when people make this accusation, they give such specific examples of it happening. And in yes, we could obviously cite, Ike's, military industrial complex speech, but you actually go into the specifics. I promise you, Raytheon did not encourage Joe Biden to do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
I
think people, it's the exact right intuition, and it illustrates how everybody kind of gets this idea of unchecked interests. And then I think you're right that it kind of distracts us from the things that actually take us to war. So when I think about the private unchecked interests that actually on a day-to-day basis bring to war, I think, so when it comes to civil wars, for example, where I spend a lot of time working, rebel leaders and warlords and presidents who realize that they can make more money in the war economy than out have an incentive to preserve the violence and maybe even start that war in the first place. That's really common. And it could be conflict diamonds or conflict timber or conflict coltan or all sorts of things. Drugs are another big one. When it comes to democratically elected leaders, I think the fact that many of our leaders are insulated from the costs of war, and so they can pursue their ideological or whatever other objectives without fully internalizing it, partly because they only get elected every so often, partly because they might have an incumbency advantage. They've built in lots of protection from actually losing office. There's even a famous study that shows that as soon as you have like a draft age son, you suddenly become really anti-war in Congress. And this is true for like 150 years, but not if you have a draft age daughter, which is basically just nature's flip of the coin. And so there are all these little ways in which we're insulated from the costs of war as decision makers, even in a democracy. And I just think those on a routine basis are much more common than the military industrial complex.
Yeah, no, it's just interesting. I actually like what I love about the framework that you provide in this book is like, don't focus on things that happened, focus on things that didn't happen. Mm. And once again, the thing that'd be interesting for me in the Ukraine example is, look, there was an 8-year war in the Donbass before.
Yeah.
If there is this serious causal relationship between the military industrial complex and escalation, why wouldn't this have started in 2014 in terms of as aggressive the US was? The US didn't supply heavy weapons until like 2017, 2018. So once again, it's not to say that there isn't a dynamic there. It's just that by asking yourself the question, okay, well, why didn't this happen in those previous cases? We could see that there are probably not such a literal direct relationship there. So let's get to the second one, which is this intangible. I think this is my favorite one, by the way, intangible incentives.
Yeah. This is just to say that sometimes war is valuable in and of itself, or war delivers something that only violence can. And therefore you're aware of the costs, but you're willing to pay them for this intangible, ethereal, often ideological objective. And sometimes those are, we don't think of those as terribly noble. It could be glory, national status, and prestige, visions of grandeur for your ethno-nationalist linguistic group, whatever. That's what a lot of people say is motivating Putin, right? They're basically saying, yes, war is costly. Putin's willing to pay this because he's getting something from this that he can't get otherwise, this ideological gain. But then you can turn it around and you can say the same is true of Ukrainians, that Ukrainians were given a really miserable choice. They were kind of like we talked about a minute ago, sort of like China has given its ethnic groups and sort of the far-flung provinces and autocrats have given people throughout history. They're like, you're going to get semi-sovereignty and you're going to live with it because we're strong. And they said, no way. They said liberty and this is just too important. We would rather die than accept this, which is its own kind of intangible incentive. This idea that there are repugnant compromises we won't accept. And I think of it, you know, that's the story of the American Revolution, which is what I write about in the book, is that an imperial tyrannical superpower offered a relatively weak colony semi-sovereignty. And they said, no way, largely for ideological reasons. So this isn't a story of like strategically gaming out that this is going to be optimal for us. And it's not about ignoring the costs because we don't pay them. It's saying there's this thing I get, this ethereal thing, and I will pay the price to get it.
You know, that brings to mind a question I've always just wondered strategically. And I know you're not a Russia area expert, so we could keep this hypothetical as you need to be comfortable. But I don't understand why aggressors frame aggression in ways that prevent compromise. Mm-hmm. So my line on this has always been, the second that Putin wrote that big essay and gave that big speech questioning the existence of Ukrainian identity, mm-hmm. my perspective was, okay, they're going to have to fight because that is the definition. Because when you write that essay, it's near impossible for Zelensky to say, okay, we're going to leave Crimea. Because then the thought is like, but wait, he's just saying that and then he'll come later because he says that your nation shouldn't even. So I think something that Hitler did very well until Poland was always leave the compromise. Mm-hmm. Allies, I'm just taking the Sudetenland. Yeah. You don't care. I'm just reuniting with Austria. They speak German anyways. You don't care. He was good at that until he did it a little too much. But Putin just, it seems right off the bat, just killed compromise. Killed a rationale or gave a rationale that would make it near impossible to compromise before the war.
So he might have. That might be true. He might have done that for ideological reasons. Another way to look at it, and I don't know, because none of us can really peer inside his head. Imagine you're like negotiating for a used car and you say, I could never pay that. Like, not in a million years could I ever afford this. Like, you don't actually mean that, right? You might rule out verbally all sorts of potential compromises, but you both know that it's a degree of posturing, but you're trying to signal something. You might even go so far as to actually make some of those, you might actually try to like all the possible compromises on price, you could try to eliminate all of those unfavorable to you by like, you know what, I'm going to like, maybe I'm only going to bring so much money with me to the market before I go. I'm actually going to limit how far I could go, or I'm going to, you know, promise my wife I can't do more. Like, I'm actually going to make promises, or as a leader, I'm going to actually build up a certain amount of antipathy towards certain compromises so that I can credibly signal to my opponent that all of these things that are in theory in our bargaining range, I'm going to eliminate them and try, or as a public, I'm going to elect a hawkish leader who just hates the idea of compromise in order to eliminate a whole range of possible bargains, not to eliminate the possibility of compromise, but to narrow it in a way that's favorable to me. It's just a classic bargaining strategy. And we all do it intuitively when we buy a used car. And so not surprisingly, leaders who are thinking about this very carefully do it. but it's a delicate game. And then sometimes they really mean it, right? And so that's, and you don't really know. That's like the part of the mystery, right? Like, you kind of have an incentive to pretend like you're the, even if you're not the crazy person who's super ideological, you actually have some incentives to bluff, you know? And that is, and that's part of this delicate strategic dance that can lead us to war.
You know, what you just said brought to mind something you also said on Tyler Cowen's podcast, where you specifically stated that you don't treat, and correct me, I'm not going to quote you perfectly. Yeah. You don't take public speeches by leaders as just this mm-hmm. very determinant thing. And obviously Tyler brought up, well, you know, Hitler wrote Mein Kampf, where he literally said, I'm going to do to Russia what he did to Russia. You know, we could find these examples, but then at the other, you know, on the other hand, I'm realizing here, like, and look, like President Obama, when he was elected, you know, he said, we're not going to engage in wars of choice. Yeah. Muammar Gaddafi made a bunch of decisions, I think, based on the idea that there would be no Western intervention, and look where he ended up. So you can't take these things literally. So I 100% understand the thought process there. But if we can't take these things literally,
yeah,
or predictively, how does the negotiation actually go about? Do you understand? Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, how are you supposed to do it?
Well, it's related to an idea that people call cheap talk, and you can't really, you can get a little bit of information from cheap talk. What you're really looking for is for your adversary to send you really credible signals. It actually gets us to like the third. So we've talked about unchecked leaders. We've talked about intangible incentives. Now we can talk about uncertainty, where the fact is it's really uncertain. How resolved is your adversary? Is Putin bluffing? You know, think about 3 months. Is he bluffing, or is he really willing to do this? Is he really that ideological, or is he posturing? And not just posturing, but he has an incentive to pretend in order to rile his population up so that they're willing to, so that he can credibly threaten, so he can arm, so he can, right? So you're as a politician, you're constantly trying to manufacture a view in your populace that you hope doesn't backfire against you when you eventually have to compromise. Right. Same thing with the United States in the fight with the Taliban. Never a compromise with the Taliban. Never, never, never. It's a bargaining tactic. Then, of course, eventually we settle with the Taliban. And so you have to manufacture. Not only do you have to do this cheap talk, not only do you have to try to signal your seriousness with more costly things, because we live in an uncertain world where your resolve is unclear. You actually have to try to construct some of that and fool your own population so that that gives your bargaining power against your opponent. So it's quite complicated. But the fundamental problem is that our strength is not written on our forehead, whether we're a nation or an individual. And so we can fake it. And our enemy knows we might be faking it. And so you're engaged and you're trying to avoid war while also getting the best deal you can by faking it just enough. And it's a dangerous dance. It's strategically, quote unquote, optimal, because it's actually your best strategy. Just like in poker, sometimes it makes sense to bluff. Sometimes it makes sense to call. Sometimes it makes sense to fold. It's the same logic applies in the context of warfare. And unfortunately, the outcome of calling is, and bluffing and calling can be pretty miserable.
You know, in these examples we're thinking of, I take back saying that number two, intangible incentives, is my favorite, because uncertainty is my favorite, because it seems to me that if we're looking at probable future conflicts,
we can't take what you say at face value.
Yeah, you can't, right? I'm just talking. I'm filling time when I'm speaking to someone for an hour. But you know, it's, for example, look at a probable or possible conflict in Taiwan. The U.S. has a strategically ambiguous relationship towards Taiwan. Would we defend Taiwan? Would we interdict a Chinese invasion? Is there, like, what's the degree there? And then if you look at, you know, if you look at World War II, Hitler did not believe the Allies were serious when they said they would intervene on Poland's behalf. No. If you look at the Russia invasion of Ukraine, whether or not it's up for grabs whether Putin still would have invaded, but almost certainly everyone agrees the level of Western / allied response was not expected in any way whatsoever. I guess this is hard to answer because it's game theory.
Right.
Is uncertainty something we should seek to reduce to the minimum, or should mm-hmm. we just be comfortable with it?
In fact, you know, a lot of peacemaking interventions, whether it's at a courtroom or labor battles or between nations or civil wars or whatever, is about uncertainty reducing. This is the principal job of a mediator, right? A mediator is trying to be a credible interlocutor who's able to assess forces and communicate things to between sides. This is actually the primary function of US peacekeeping forces. I mean, they've got a couple functions, but basically cantoning forces and helping forces basically count the number of people, make sure everybody's there, and disarm in a controlled way is about uncertainty reducing. And just you walk through a lot of alternative dispute resolution techniques, which are used in courts, they're used in villages, they're used in ethnic conflicts, they're used by mediators at the international level, are all about reducing uncertainty. And so it's actually like a really tried and true peacekeeping tactic.
So let's get to the, in our last 10 minutes, let's get to the fourth one. So commitment problems.
Well, you know, I'm going to bypass that and say, let's talk about misperceptions because it connects so well with uncertainty.
Great.
Because we, you know, a lot of people tell the story of Putin being isolated, insulated, overconfident, underestimating the costs, right? So once again, just like these last three stories, the reason we fought, the answer to why we fight is a reason that somebody ignored the costs. In this case, it was a mistake, a misperception. He was just erroneously informed. Surely true. Surely true because he's an autocrat who sort of institutionally is isolated, and also because many leaders, CEOs, mutual fund managers, presidents have a tendency to be overconfident, underestimate the difficulties of situations. But I think we put a little bit too much weight on that and forget just how uncertain all these things you just mentioned are, how uncertain Ukrainian strength and resolve was, how uncertain the Russian military ability was, how uncertain was Western unity. And the idea that Russia would get a bad draw on all three of those things, I think nobody really predicted, least of all Vladimir Putin, obviously. And so, yes, it's a mistake ex post, but ex ante, it's not clear. It was just a gamble. In addition, I think he misperceived a lot of these things. And that's this fourth category of misperceptions. It's amidst uncertainty, we have all of these human and institutional capacities for bias that lead us to misestimate the costs and therefore be too ready to use violence.
I think that sums it up. And once again, for folks who are going to check the book out, I think we cover that in, you know, 20 minutes, but there's a lot of nuance there. So I think in this last section, we were talking before this episode, and I want to get to something interesting, which is you pointed out that, there are a lot of folks. Like actually, Fred Kagan is a good example of this. I took some courses with him, and he's at the Institute for Study of War. He's doing a lot of like analysis of the war. And Fred was a Sovietologist, so he actually like got his PhD planning to be there for the Cold War. And you know, you spend 20 years in, you have the 90s, you have the 2000s, the War on Terror, and now that is relevant again.
Yeah,
you did not think you were going to be focusing on let's say great power conflict.
No.
Most people are going to hear this book and think of it through the lens of Russia and China.
Right.
What did you really see? A, what did you see yourself writing this, the lens of this book in? And then like, what was your actual career? Not like every single job you did, people could get your background pretty easily, but like the impetus.
Yeah, I mean, my background, I started off working in civil wars in West Africa, first Northern Uganda, and also Liberia, and thinking about the sort of warlord government conflict. And then I transitioned to working in, and I did that because that was what seemed really relevant in the 90s and the early 2000s. And then in the last 5 or 10 years, you know, the thing that I'm really worried about, I think is probably the national security issue of the next century, even if we're not talking about it very much, is just cartels, organized crime. Now that we have all sorts of states that are quite strong, right, as we don't have as many weak and fragile states, all of these former warlords are like, well, I might as well just make my money controlling the city or controlling this drug trade or controlling that. And I think there's going to be a lot of state gang violence and a lot of gang violence. And so I started turning to study that. And it was through this lens of studying villages warring and rebel groups warring and gangs warring that I realized that so many of the lessons I was learning from international conflict and teaching about international conflict a lot of the, obviously these things are super different, but I focused on what I was learning that they have held in common. And so that ended up being the core of the book, which is like the first half of the book is about why we fight, whether we're a gang or a village or nations or political factions. And the second half of the book is about how we get to peace. But it's, again, it's all these echoes of actually, oh, look at these things that are working at the city level kind of make sense at the international level. And we can learn from them. These things that are working at the international level kind of maybe that gives us ideas for things at the village level or the civil war level. And so I just see a lot of, you know, gains from trade.
I think the last question would be, I'm curious about your optimism or pessimism on this topic of conflict in the 21st century, because, you know, a key takeaway is war is ruinous and war has only become more ruinous, which is why it's easy to see. And it's easy to see interstate conflict just decreasing and even internal conflict, right? Like, you know, Scotland almost left the UK. If that had happened, it would have been far more peaceful than that would have been 200 years ago, obviously. So what's your perception of this?
Yeah. So let's say we're entering, you know, we've already been fighting a drug war in this country for decades. Mexico is fighting a drug war against cartels. Colombia is fighting a drug. We're all fighting wars against strong gangs and cartels selling illicit products. So that war is costly, right? So why aren't we settling? Right. Why? And we have, you know, for a long time, the Mexican government was basically been settled with the cartels. This is the pre-government. They would they basically tax them, make a lot of money, corruptly stay in power. It was peaceful. Lots of cities kind of make quiet pacts with gangs to stop fighting. You know, we'll leave your drug profits intact. You guys keep the streets a little quieter. We've seen that in El Salvador. Some American cities do it. It happens in Colombia. The reason we fight more often than not is this intangible ideological incentive. It's the fact that most democratic countries find the idea of compromise with drug gangs repugnant. And so we fight in spite of it making so-called sense to avoid the cost. We fight because we're willing to pay that price. So it's just like the American revolutionaries fighting. It's just like the Ukrainian freedom fighters, you know, pushing back against Russia. We will run a forever war against these groups because the idea of compromise is repugnant. And that to me is not going to change anytime soon.
Do you have a final follow-up here? Do you have a metric for when leaders, and this is so hard, right? It's so specific, but how should leaders conceptualize compromise as a framework? Because the negative of compromise is appeasement, right? These words have very negative connotations.
Yeah, I mean, compromises sometimes mean official settlements. We sit down and, you know, that's not going to happen. You're not going to sit down at a bargaining table with the drug leader. I mean, actually, sometimes they do, but sit down and say, all right, you guys will do this and I do that. And a lot of that compromise, a lot of that bargaining is like a dance where you're not directly talking, but you're basically occupying your positions, not attacking one another. It's like a de facto kind of settlement. That's also what stalemates look like. We're just going to stop fighting because we're exhausted, and you'll sit on your territory and I'll sit on mine, and we won't act aggressively, and we'll kind of coordinate on that because we both know it's destructive. So it happens in all sorts of ways. And you know, a mayor becoming elected, or a president becoming elected and just saying, you know what, I'm just going to hit the pause button on the drug war, and an informal channel will sort of communicate that you guys control your violence, we'll control our violence, because I'd really rather work on healthcare or something. That's a settlement of sorts, right? And so that kind of thing is happening all the time. So it's just not official, okay? But yeah, you're exactly right. We call it appeasement when it's repugnant.
Also, I'm realizing when it's official. So what's actually so funny is what you're actually seeing is in these like infamous examples of overcompromise or appeasement, you know, when it's a warranted word, it's when you take these semi-implicit processes and make them a little too manifestly obvious. Yeah. And that's kind of what politics is. Like, politics is not having that be so obvious. So Chris, this has been really great. Would love for you just to shout the book Why We Fight Out. It's available at our bookshop and anywhere else you can find your books. The audiobook it's also very good. I've listened to the audiobook version. It's a well done audiobook.
I spent a lot of time selecting. I think the guy is the perfect narrator and very, he's fabulous job. So that's great. But thank you for having me.
Thank you. Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.